how they're different, it seems like so many times they're really intertwined, kind of like our friends' anxiety and depression. They usually go together. But they are a little bit different. And one of the first feelings that the humans are described as not yet having is shame. And the two of them were naked, the human and his woman, and they were not ashamed, which seems good. And those of us who are parents remember that stage, right? When our kids play in the pool and they don't notice whether they have a bathing suit or not and they don't care. And it's kind of sad when that goes away. We have to cover up all those pictures in the photo albums with little sticky things because we don't like people looking back and seeing that we were naked and they knew and we didn't and we're ashamed. Shame is a focus on identity. I am bad, rather than guilt, which is I did something wrong or I made a mistake. And they've done a lot of research now on how shaming is not good for children, to shame them. Makes them feel bad about themselves. And as parents, we don't want that for our kids. We all make mistakes, but we don't want them to feel that they're bad people. And I think as God is parent, that couldn't have been good for God either. I can't imagine that God wanted his creation to feel shame. As parents, we wish that we could protect our kids, that they could understand that we love them no matter what they do, that they wouldn't feel the need to hide from us. I wonder if we can empathize a little bit with God as parents when our kids do things that hurt themselves and we're sad for them, when we're sad for their loss of innocence. I keep wondering why Genesis is relevant to us so many years later. Why does it matter? How do I convince the teenagers that it matters? But like Kai said, understanding that our origin is from a God of peace, from a God of love, that humans were God's design and God's image, is really different from understanding us as coming from violence or as an afterthought. Our understanding of creation and our relationship to God affects everything about who we are. Oliver, if you'd read the next part.
And the serpent was the subtlest of all the wild beasts that Yahweh Elohim had made. And he said to the woman, "Did Elohim really say that you are not to eat from all the trees of the garden?" The woman said to the serpent, "We eat from the trees of the garden, but from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, Elohim said to us, 'You don't eat from it, and you don't touch it, lest you die.'" And the serpent said to the woman, "You shall not be doomed to die. For Elohim knows that on the day you eat from it, then your eyes will be open, and you will be like Elohim, knowing good and evil." And the woman saw that the tree was good for eating, and that it was lust to the eyes, and the tree was desirable to bring wisdom. And she took some of its fruit and ate it, and gave it to her man with her, and he ate. And the eyes of the two were opened, and they knew that they were naked. They sewed up fig leaves and made themselves loincloths.
There were a few interesting things that leapt out to me when I read this again. The snake twisting Yahweh's commandment, "You can't eat from all the trees of the garden." And the woman's contradiction of the serpent, we eat from the trees of the garden, just the one. And that we can't even touch it, which wasn't in the original pronouncement. Reminding us that actually the woman wasn't there when Yahweh Elohim gave this original commandment. Only the human was there. And the snake wasn't there yet either. And so either they're working off secondhand information that the man has told them, or perhaps Yahweh has reiterated this command and it's just not recorded. But in either case, the serpent is twisting Yahweh's words. And for the woman, she's doing something that actually is much later practice in Judaism, which is called building a fence around something, making it even a little bit more difficult. So you can't even touch the tree. That would make it safer so that you stay further away from the thing that you're not supposed to do, which makes a lot of sense until you get close to the fence and realize that the tree is good for eating and is lust to the eyes and desirable to bring wisdom. As a community that's pretty focused on knowledge and wisdom, I think it's hard for us to caution against wanting those things. As Ron pointed out last week, it's interesting, the man is there and doesn't say anything. You wonder if he's waiting to see if she dies or not. Things were poisonous, you know? Things like, there's a tree that has things that look like apples. We'll see a picture later. And if you eat it, you will die, right? So it's possible that the tree is poisonous and Adam's waiting to see what's going to happen. But he doesn't say anything, which is interesting. He's not so much the protector as we sometimes think of men maybe being. In fact, he's just waiting to see what's going to happen. Because supposedly they're supposed to die on the very day they eat of it, which they don't, but we'll come back to that later. Instead, it brings us to the very first clothing episode, which must not have gone too well because they still needed to hide.
They heard the sound of Yahweh Elohim walking in the garden in the evening breeze, and the human and his woman hid from the presence of Yahweh Elohim in the midst of the garden's trees. And Yahweh Elohim called to the human and said to him, Where are you?
And Yahweh... I was wondering what the sound of Yahweh Elohim walking in the garden was like. So I Googled some images to see what artists may have come up with, and one of them was music. And it's interesting to think of the sound of God walking in the garden as being music, rather than crashing through the branches or maybe some old bearded white man footfalls. Rather, I wonder, what kind of music might that have been? But the humans hid from the presence of Yahweh, particularly from Yahweh's sight. Is it like when children become teenagers and they no longer want their parents to see them naked? Like there was a kind of instant growing up. They are no longer children and understanding they have the nakedness of adults. That maturity came suddenly with a bite of fruit rather than a gradual realization, and it was quite a shock. But as a teacher, I'm fascinated by the questions that God asks. Where are you? What is the tone of that? Is it mournful, saddened by the loss of innocence and relationship, knowing that things will never be the same again? I was talking with Jubal about this in the car. He's at the Bears game today. And he said he always heard it as, where are you? Which is pretty different, right? And maybe we get that from our parents, how they said, where are you to us when we might have done something wrong? Does Elohim not know where they are? Does Yahweh not know what has transpired? We think of God as all-powerful and all-knowing, but at least in this story, Yahweh is not presented that way. Or perhaps it is that this God prefers to ask, to call, to beckon us. Where are you? We who are familiar with hiding from God, we who are familiar with shame, and with guilt, Do we hear Yahweh Elohim calling to us when we are hiding? Where are you? Perhaps that is the question from the very beginning in the loss of innocence that still extends to us today. And so Adam responds, I heard your sound in the garden, and I was afraid because I am naked, and I hid. I expect him to say, I was afraid because I disobeyed you. I was afraid because you said we would die. Or I was ashamed because I was naked and I hid. But rather it's, I was afraid because I was naked. It's strange that Adam went straight to fear and doesn't mention disobedience or guilt. I'm not sure if he doesn't feel that. He's really concentrating on the shame. Or is he hoping that maybe Elohim will think that he figured it out on his own and he won't know that they ate from the tree? Whatever the reason, Adam seems to think, or at least communicate, that the nakedness is the primary problem. At least that's what he and the woman have tried to solve with their rudimentary sewing of the fig leaves, plus the hiding, since that didn't work so well. And so Yahweh Elohim responds, and he said, who told you that you were naked? The second question is who. The first is where. The second is who. Because Yahweh Elohim knows they couldn't have figured it out on their own. I do wonder how long they were in the garden before this happened, eating from various trees, serving the ground, taking care of the animals. Days? Years? How many evenings did they walk together? How long did that innocence last before the snake got bored and decided to turn crafty? I've never really thought of Adam and Eve as youngsters before, but it seems interesting and maybe helpful to think about them as growing up in the garden, having wonder and delight and innocence for years before the serpent decided it was time to make its move. Regardless, immediately following the question of who, before the humans have time to respond, Yahweh Elohim puts it together, perhaps because they knew all along, following the second question closely with the third. From that tree, I ordered you not to eat of it. Have you eaten? Have you? After I told you not to? So that the man chooses to mix the two questions together, taking the who from the first question, but not who told him who he was naked, but who to blame for the eating. The original instruction was to him, after all. But Adam decides to go with the double blame. That woman whom you put with me, she gave me from the tree and I ate. First blaming the woman, and then reminding Elohim who is at fault for putting the woman there in the first place. And then at the end, I ate. So familiar to us who are parents or teachers, when we ask who did it, we start finger pointing and blaming immediately. Which leads to the next question, the what. And the Lord God said to the woman, what is this that you have done? Which seems a little rhetorical since the evidence is already out there, but the woman also chooses to pass the buck. And the woman said, the serpent beguiled me, and I ate. A lovely parallel to the man's answer, although she does not blame Yahweh for creating the serpent, or the man for not reminding her, since he was the one who got the commandment in the first place. And this is where the questions stop. We have the who, what, where. I guess the when is kind of obvious since whenever they last walked together. But I'm fascinated by the lack of why. I mean, probably in ancient Hebrew they weren't into who, what, when, where, why. But how come there's no why? Was it because the why was obvious? Was it only a matter of time before the one thing that was prohibited was partaken? Which brings us back to the original command, to the human. Before Yahweh Elohim noticed that the human being alone was not good, before Yahweh Elohim formed the beast from the ground, and before they built the woman.
And Yahweh Elohim commanded the human, saying, "From all the trees of the garden you are free to eat, and from the tree of knowing good and evil you are not to eat from it, because on the day you eat from it, you will certainly die."
So here's a picture of that tree that I referenced. I think in Spanish it's called, oops, we're not there yet. In Spanish it's called the little apple of death. Just kind of rough. So whether or not Yahweh already knew that the humans had eaten from the tree, now it's out there. They've both blamed others to greater or lesser degree, but have ended by saying, "I ate." Which, according to the warning, on the day the human eats from it, he will certainly die. Maybe that is the when that is missing. This day. The day of death. Except that's not what happens. So maybe here is where we need to ask the why. Why not? Why didn't they certainly die on that day? Did Yahweh Elohim have a change of mind or heart? If it was a poisonous tree, perhaps, it wasn't that Yahweh Elohim would kill them, but that it could kill them, the tree itself. When I was originally thinking about this teaching, I really wanted to skip the curses for the sake of time, obviously. And because I didn't feel equipped to deal with them, I was hoping Ron would, which he kind of did. And I didn't want to read them aloud. And yet there are a few things that I noticed that seemed worth talking about. The first is that Yahweh Elohim does not deign to ask the serpent any questions. Yahweh hears the man's response and the woman's response and turns to the snake and says,
"And the Lord God said to the serpent, 'Because you have done this, cursed be you of all cattle and all beasts of the field. On your belly shall you go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. Enmity will I set between you and the woman, between your seed and hers. He will boot your head, and you will bite his heel.'"
But Yahweh Elohim does not curse either of the humans. He curses the serpent, and later we'll see that he curses the soil. But he doesn't curse the humans. Rather, it is their pain and the poison of this knowledge that is described. And as Oliver will read in a minute, there is a kind of parallelism in their pain. The pain of bringing forth, of producing children or food. Producing, women produce children, men produce food in the ancient times perhaps, but both of those were filled with pain. So now Oliver will read those.
"To the woman he said, 'I will terribly sharpen your birth pangs. In pain shall you bear children. And for your man shall be your longing, and he shall rule over you.' And to Adam he said, 'Because you listened to your woman's voice and ate from the tree that I ordered you, saying, "Do not eat from it," cursed is the ground on your account. In pain you will eat from it all the days you live. And thorns and thistles it will grow for you, and you'll eat the wild weeds. In the sweat of your brow you will eat food until you return to the ground, for you are taken from it. For you are dust, and to dust you shall return."
As much of these pronouncements of pain kind of irk me. I've also been thinking about how these are not the most painful things in our lives. I've given birth twice, unmedicated, and I know several farmers who are even here today who've chosen to farm. And the pain of these activities pale in comparison to the joys of bringing forth children or food to feed us all. There are a lot more painful things than childbirth or farming. Those are the other things that I'd like to take up with God. But the thing is, they did not die on the day they ate. Maybe, and perhaps certainly, they were poisoned. But something, someone stepped in, intervened. If the tree was poisoned, then God intervened and did not allow them to die. How would that change our understanding of God? Particularly if we grew up thinking that God cursed humans, especially women. Or if we always heard about original sin, but never the concept of original blessing. That at the beginning it was good, observed by Yahweh Elohim finally to be very good. And the word sin is not used anywhere in this text, nor is disobedience or disobey or guilt. Yahweh's indictment of the human is that rather than listening to God's voice, the voice that told him not to eat, he listened to the woman's voice, and she listened to the snake's voice. Maybe it's less about disobedience and more about the voices that we listen to. Do we listen to God's voice, trusting that Yahweh wants the best for us? Or to the voices that call into question God's motives, voices that say, despite being created in God's image, Yahweh Elohim doesn't want us to be like them. When we choose to listen to those voices, to doubt God's love and care for us, our choices produce pain, both for ourselves and those around us. Can I go twice? There, yes. How would it change our understanding of Yahweh to be the one who averts death, the one who saves us from poison, who comes looking for us, drawing us out, meeting us where we are? And when we are ashamed, instead of God shaming us, God clothes us. God meets us in our shame, knowing that we are hiding our very selves from God, and calls us out of the woods, and looks with compassion on our poor attempts to cover our shame, and gives us some help. What might this story tell us about the character of God? How might it be different from what we thought it said? That's why Genesis is still relevant. What we believe about ourselves, our relationship with each other, our understanding of our connection to the divine, shapes our understanding of self, the way we deal with shame, our experience of fear, our concept of loneliness, our belief in judgment, salvation, and mercy. One more. Skip that one, Rich. There, thanks. This evening marks the beginning of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. Perhaps we can start this new year with a sweeter understanding of Yahweh Elohim, not as a God of fear to hide from, not as a God primarily interested in guilt and punishment, but as a God who searches for us, asking, "Where are you?" To repair the relationship, not to kill us, but to save us from death, not to punish us, but to clothe us. And we, in our shame for just being who we are, can we come out into the light to be seen and known, by Yahweh Elohim, who created us in their image, to be accepted and loved, even as we have left innocence behind and now have to deal with the burden of so much knowledge. And as a community, can we cease to blame each other? Cease saying to God, "It was that one, the one you put with me. They did it first." Do we believe that God is not interested in the blaming? That God wants to restore us to right relationship with God's self and with each other? Going to the communion table is one way to step into God's presence, to allow God to see us, to experience God's mercy. God is calling you. God is calling me. God is calling us. May we be able to overcome our fear and step out into the light to answer God's call. Where are you?